welcome to this week's Radio Dialect. We're streaming live from the Trinity Arts Centre in Bristol. It's downloadable from radiodialect.net. My name's John Peters Coleman, and after tonight's local news and long-range weather forecast, we'll be bringing you full entertainment from Radio Dialect. Norman Eshley will be with us in the studio for an interesting view on his life as a very successful actor on television and screen. Our recipe for soup, I like these recipes, will be coming direct from St. Nicholas Market. Over now to Richard Ayres, as per usual, for the news, followed by the two-week weather forecast for the Bristol region.
On Tuesday, the Independent newspaper featured an in-depth report of the ongoing violence in Iraq. A special dispatch from Patrick Coburn in Iraq described the country being torn apart by civil war. Everything in Iraq is dominated by the so-called politics of the last atrocities. All three Iraqi communities, Shia, Sunni and Kurds, see themselves as victims with little sympathy for the other parties. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says that 1.6 million people are displaced within the country. A further 1.8 million have fled abroad. 665 Iraqis have died as a result of the invasion. Tony Blair and George Bush are still refusing to admit that the occupation of the country by foreign troops has been the main cause of the insurgency. An Iraqi government will only have real legitimacy and freedom to rate when the occupying troops have withdrawn. Mr. Coburn believes that Iraq will only survive if Washington and London accept a Shia Kurdish loose federation, because they make up 80% of the population. So is the Iraq war about oil, as many people believe it is? What's the alternative? And yesterday's Guardian ran a story about a Canadian company, a biofuel group called Dynamotive, who are creating an alternative green fuel from a new source of energy, human waste. Scientists at Dynamotive say that oil produced from human waste can be used instead of fossil fuels to generate heat and power in diesel engines and boilers. They have already carried out a pilot scheme and are now looking at ways to produce the oil on a commercial scale. Andrew Kingston, resident and chief executive officer at Dynamotive, said, "There are no process issues at this point to stop us using human sewage sludge. If we can supply the oil, then people will use it." Here in Bristol this week, developers involved in the controversial site at Castle Park, Dealey Fried, have been asked by the city planners to modify the plans after huge opposition to the development, which could have resulted in concreting over some green spaces. Councillor White, part of the city regeneration team, will now recommend her cabinet colleagues to back a revised proposal that protects the areas most used by the public. The council has asked Dealey Fried to put forward its new proposal to a cabinet meeting early in 2007. It was decided this week that the new shopping centre in Broadmead will be called Cabot, after the famous explorer. The team behind the £500 million development finally announced the name after a long period of deliberation. Bristol Alliance marketing manager Bob Graham said, "Our overall objective has always been to choose a name that reflects the aspirations of all those who live, work and shop in Bristol." He said the name evoked Bristol's entrepreneurial spirit. Complete Control, a company based at Keynsham, has won a BAFTA Children's Award for an innovative learning programme for children. Devised by the charity Oxfam, the winning entry in the primary learning category called Mapping Our World used new computer technology, including 9 interactive games, to help children understand more about the world. The company works on projects for a number of well-known TV companies, including BBC Worldwide. Aardman also picked up a Best Feature Film Gong Award at this year's ceremony for their entry Wallace and Gromit: The Curse of the Were-Rabbit. Now for weather. The outlook is warm for December, temperatures staying up around 10 degrees C in the afternoons, and this pattern will continue through to the Monday the 4th, with strong blustery winds and showers though. Saturday and Sunday will be dry. Expect rain to come in on Sunday evening, with heavy rain all day on Monday the 11th of December. The following week will stay fairly dry, with temperatures dropping to an average of 6 degrees, with a wind chill which will make it feel colder. The weekend of 9th and 10th of December will still be cold, with Saturday will be dry and Sunday wet. And temperatures for the week beginning on the 11th will start to creep up again. There will be a mixture of rain and cloud, but stay mostly dry.
All right, thank you, Richard. We've got Norman Eshley in here in the studio with us. We'll be talking to him straight after we've had a piece of music.
All right, get ready. Here we go. A little by blue can blow up your horn. The sheep's in the meadow and the cow's in the corn. Aye, aye, aye. Where is the boy who looks after the sheep? He's under the haystack with little Bo Peep. Aye, aye, aye. Uh-huh, 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 uh-huh. Right on. Uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. Uh-huh. Right, name of the game. Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet, her knickers all tattered and torn. It wasn't a spider who sat beside her, it was little by blue with the arm. Uh-huh, 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 uh-huh. Right on, here we go. Icky-tacka, ticky-tacka, ticky-tacka, tire. Whoop-a-ya, pussy catch a fire. Yeah. A little by blue. Uh-huh, 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 yeah. Black pussy, white pussy, pink pussy, blue. The name of the game is a little by blue. Aye. Uh-huh, 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 uh-huh. Right on, here we go. Rasta for I, a rasta for me, a little by blue in a ganja tree, smoking the weed. Aha, 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 yeah. By blue stood on the burning deck, playing a game of cricket. The ball rolled up his trouser leg and he stumped his middle wicket. Aha, aha, aha. Uh-huh, right on, here we go. Icky-tacka, ticky-tacka, ticky-tacka, tire. Whoop-a-ya, pussy catch a fire. Yeah, a little by blue. Uh-huh, 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 yeah. Black pussy, white pussy, pink pussy, blue. The name of the game is a little by blue. Bye.
Radio Dialect is your local internet radio station. Check our website on radiodialect.net.
Right, that was Judge Dredd with Big Six, one of my favourites. We've got Norman Ashley in the studio with us now. He's in the hot seats. Norman Ashley, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, John. Very well.
Excellent, I can hear you well. Now, tell us a bit about yourself for sort of those who may not know the name of Norman Ashley.
I suppose the thing they know me most for is the long string of Neighbour and George and Mildred next door.
Okay, where you were Geoffrey Formar?
Geoffrey Formar, that's it.
Now, when did you first become an actor? How long have you been acting?
Oh, I've been acting for 40 years this year. I was 21 when I started, so you can work out how old I am. And I am a Bristolian.
Yeah.
I was born in Ashton Gate. We were allowed to move back up to Clifton when my grandfather forgave my father for having been married before.
Okay.
And we lived in Clifton at the end of the road by the old Vic School, Downfield Road.
Okay.
And I first really became interested in acting, I suppose, when I was at school. The usual thing, I went to Bristol Grammar School, and you'd join all the societies. One of them was a play society.
Yeah.
And I then sort of thought there was a chance of making a living out of it much later on, but I was invited to join the National Youth Theatre. I was one of the first people outside of London to join the National Youth Theatre.
Okay.
And I spent a summer when I was 17 working at Sadler's Wells. We did a modern-day production of Julius Caesar. And then a year after that, we were at the Old Vic, and we were doing Troilus and Cressida, and Helen Mirren was playing Cleopatra and Antony and Cleopatra, and
yeah.
There were people like Derek Jacobi were there, Tim Dalton, the James Bond, Helen, as I said. And it was a fantastic time. It was a wonderful way to spend your summer.
Yeah, must have been hugely exciting, especially when you're a teenager as well.
So. Oh, yeah, it was brilliant and wonderful. And then when I came back from there, there was an old schoolmaster of mine who's now dead, Bert Payne, and he started a Bristol Youth Theatre.
Yeah.
And he said he was going to do a production of Peer Gynt, and I was so naive, he said he wanted me to play Peer.
Okay.
I said, is it a good part? Not realising it was probably the longest part ever written. And we did that at the Victoria Rooms, and somebody from the Old Vic Theatre School saw it, and I was offered a scholarship there. And I was already working in the bank. And when I went home and told my father this, he went absolutely loopy, because he'd worked in the bank all his life.
Okay.
And we didn't talk for a couple of years between us. It was really bad. He let me stay at home, but I had to pay mum money out of my grant, which was £2.10 a week. I had to pay her 30 bob, £1.10. And I used to do part-time jobs in bars and in... Well, Bristol Zoo was one of my part-time jobs. I had a bar in Bristol Zoo. And then at the end of drama school, my dad by then was talking to me, and he said that, was there a Best Actors Award? And he said yes. He said, well, you better win that if you're going to carry on.
Okay.
And luckily I did. And I was offered then a place, the prize winners automatically go to the Old Vic. And I was offered a tour of America with the Old Vic, and I was working down there, painting No Smoking on the Wall, and by now I had an agent.
Mm-hmm.
I got a phone call from London, and my agent... asked me to go up to London. So I went up to London, I read a piece from a play to this guy I didn't know what I was doing it for. And I back to the Old Vic, spoke their painting No Smoking on the Wall, and I get a phone call saying that Orson Welles wanted to see me in Madrid. So I'd never flown before, so I dragged my bank suit out of, okay, with the mothballs and all the rest of it. And
how
put
old
it
are
on.
You at this point?
I was 21.
21?
Yeah. And I was flown out to Madrid, and I was only supposed to be there a day, coming back that evening. And Wells's wife, Paola, when I got to the house, I had stretched limousine, I had all the work, so it was quite amazing, yeah, a boy from Bristol. And his wife, Paola, came out, and she said, Norman, I'm sorry. She said, Orson cannot see you, he's just been drunk with Joseph Cotton. And so I had to wait for the evening, and then eventually I saw Wells in the evening, and this great rich voice came out and walked across the floor by, yeah, itself, and we talked, and in the end he pushed a button under the desk and a secretary came in. He said, give the guy some dough, let him go see the town. And I got outside, and that's it, you got the job.
What an amazing way to be told you've succeeded in getting a job.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was the film that you started?
The Immortal Story, and it was just four people in it. And there was a film made of the author's life, Out of Africa, with Meryl Streep. That was, yeah, the you know, Karen Blixen. And... It was just a, this old man had only believed one bit of a story in his life, and it turned out to be an absolute fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so he decided to make it happen. That was, he got a woman, and then he went and hired a sailor, and he put the two of them together to maybe create. And he had a manservant who was with us as well. Well, I was a sailor, and Jeanne Moreau was the woman. So my first day's professional work was in bed with Jeanne Moreau, directed by Orson Welles, which was quite an extraordinary experience.
So what is your first memory of acting as a profession and thinking, well, maybe I could have a go at acting?
I think it was probably the moment I walked into the Old Vic school, having decided to go there and try.
Yeah.
I'd always felt slightly, not different, but I mean, I didn't feel I was in tune. I used to play rugby at school and everything like that. But I wasn't in tune mentally with a lot of people. But when I walked in the Vic school, and suddenly there were 30 other people there who all spoke the same language, you just felt so at home, and we're just going to make it. We're all going to be great big stars, we decided at that point.
And you're only in your late teens at that
point. I was 19 then, yes.
19, so from 19 to 21,
yeah,
from your first glimpse of being an actor.
Oh, it was fantastic. Awesome. I mean, we did a little extra work on film. We were in Dave Clark 5 film, Catch Us If You Can, as extras, and
yeah.
I got paid... an extra 10 shillings for kissing my current girlfriend, which when she was paid 10 bob as well, so it was quite good. But it was a real cocoon, the school, in a way.
Mm.
So when we all left, we left friendships that have lasted this long. I mean, I still see people from my drama school days, Chris Casanova and people like that, and they're the best friends you'll ever make. And I think that possibly applies to other education establishments as well.
Yeah.
I think probably if you do a university or an intensive university course, I think you probably have the same experience. But one of our girls died, Janet Key, when she was about 47. And everybody turned up. They were all there at the funeral in London. And a lot of them had given up and gone back up north, or or they were married, some of them, you know, with grown-up children and everything, but everybody turned up to her funeral, not without exception.
I mean, you hear a lot about actors famously sort of resting and that the majority of actors don't get any work. I mean, it sounds like you've had an awful lot of work, sort of straight from the get-go. Do you feel quite lucky for that?
Well, yes, I do feel very lucky. I mean, I had the film, and then I rejoined the Old Vic to do this tour of America. Mm. But between there was probably my single most regretful moment. I mean, you get these moments in your life, and you either decide to do them or not.
Yeah.
But Wells wanted to adopt me. He didn't have a child of his own, a son of his own. And he said, he said, I want you to come and live with Paolo and I, and I will teach you in 3 years everything I know about filmmaking. Right. He just wanted to pass it on to someone. And I was quite lonely when I was doing the film, and I said no. And I mean, it's the biggest mistake of my life.
What led you to say no?
Well, partly I had the contract with the Old Vic, but I think I was scared of it.
You're too intimidating.
I mean, if you'd asked me now, I mean, or when I was 40 or 30 or something, yes, I would have. But I gave me a script which was like Hamlet on horseback, and it was he was going to play the grandfather, and I was going to play the big hero, everything. And he was never made. He was also notoriously unreliable, and he could change his mind very quickly. He was very mercurial in his temperament.
Right.
And I kind of thought, well,
does he really mean it? Did you wonder that at all?
No, he did mean it. He sat down, I had dinner with him one night, because I used to do that probably every night when we were in Spain. And he was so bad at small talk, he couldn't, you know, he'd say, how's your father, how's your mother? And I said, fine. He said, let me tell you about the time. And he'd tell me stories about people, and he'd become those people. He was the most extraordinary mimic. And films about, you know, the times he'd met people like Edward G. Robinson. And I mean, he was just incredible. But this particular evening, he sat down and he said, I've been giving it a lot of thought, and I really would like you to come and live with us, and I want to teach you everything. And he did mean it, but something in me said no. So I did. I do regret it.
It seems to be you do an awful lot of all acting genres, really, theatre, TV and film. Which was your favourite? What gives you most pleasure?
The check. It used to be at one point, and it's a bit of a cliche, everybody says theatre. I loved doing theatre when it was going well. I really loved it. But I had a really bad car smash 13 years ago, and for 4 years I couldn't remember a thing. And I tried to do a play in Nottingham, directed by Martin Clunes. And I'm usually a very quick study. And I couldn't even, the next morning, I couldn't even remember the name of the play, let alone the lines I'd supposedly learned the day before. And it came to the first preview, and I was so nervous. I was putting my lines all over the stage. I just couldn't remember things. And at that time, I didn't know I had this. It was a result of the accident. And I walked out, I'm ashamed to say, I walked away from the play. And I haven't been in the theatre since. So the actual thought of going to the theatre fills me with absolute dread.
Right.
But then I had to see a psychiatrist because of my memory and that. And he said I was suffering from a thing called frontal lobe syndrome, which means you do forget, you know. He said your memory will come back in about 4 years' time, but I've never wanted to risk that again, so okay. I'll never go on stage again.
So you're not prepared to sort of perhaps try it out and think?
No.
No.
I do like directing. I love being in a theatre, and I've written for the theatre, and I've directed, and I've directed Brian Murphy in something in London once, and it was a comedy thing. We did that in front of an audience, and I do like directing, so I like the theatre, but I don't think it's fair on an audience, and I don't think it's fair on me to put myself under that sort of pressure again.
Would you continue to do any sort of TV or film work?
Not in the immediate future, because I'm my mother's carer.
Okay.
She's 90 the other day, and she's had a series of strokes, so I look after her full time, and I mean, if the odd voiceovers and things come along in Bristol, I'll do those, but I can't really see myself doing much in the way of television. Unless it was something like, if it was Casualty, then yeah, I'd do that because it's done in Bristol.
Yeah.
But I don't really want to go away.
Okay.
And that's it.
Okay. You've also featured in a film with Mia Farrow, I read. 1971, you played a lead character called Steve in Blind Terror.
Yeah. Well, when I got this film, I'll tell you how I got it, actually, it was my first play in the West End ever. It was Vivat Regina with Sarah Miles and Eileen Atkins, and Dame Eileen Atkins there. And I did the first night and went back to my flat and was painting the wall again. I must take up more painting, I think. And I got a phone call from my agent saying that Richard Fleischer wanted to see me, the director. And I went along then. He said, caught your show last night, Norman. How would you like to play opposite Mia Farrow in a film? I said, yes, please. And he's then sent all these famous actors outside away. And it was just one of those really real coincidences. It was beautiful, it happened. And I started filming, and I was doing the play in the evening at the same time. And it was 6 weeks of filming. And we had a great time. And, this is one time I had to kiss Mia. And we were riding on horses in the rain, and it wasn't real rain. We had fire engines spraying water into the sky. And
yeah.
I was trying to be very professional and say, look, I'm going to be professional about this, Mia, don't worry. And so I said to her, just before I kissed her, don't worry, Mia, I don't fancy you.
Oh, no.
Which is probably the worst thing you could ever say to someone. But then she...
Did she get the point that you were trying
I was trying to explain to her. She still, still wasn't happy with the way I said it.
Right.
But it was a Sunday when we were doing this particular scene. And we sat in the back of a car together afterwards, and we were absolutely drenched and soaked, and it was miserable. And she produced a bottle of brandy, so we got pissed together. So it was all right. I was forgiven the next day.
All right. All right. Well, we've got a few more things to talk about, but I think we'll have a break for some music. So we're going to stop for a tune now. Good.
Shaggy, are you in there?
I'm busy right now.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no. Mommy came in and she caught me one-handed, dreaming about the girl next door. Picture this, I was working at Kirk and should have locked the bedroom door. How could I get caught while I was picking up a pound of meat? All this time she was standing there, I'm polishing my good friend Pete.
When you are young, you need a little thriller. Keep a dirty magazine underneath your pillow. You'll never admit when you didn't ride your stick or when you've been wrestling with a one-eyed snake.
A box of Kleenex on the counter.
I wasn't neat.
A tube of lotion on the sofa.
To beat my meat.
Hear my breathing getting louder.
I wasn't heat.
All of a sudden it was over. Mommy came in and she caught me one-handed, looking for the unicorn. Picture this, I had roped that pony, had him in a tug of war. How could I be casual while the general salutes my feet? And the bishop, he was standing there, shivering for lack of heat. Can you tell that I'm embarrassed for the shame that I caused? So that purple-headed warrior will have to be flawed.
When you start simulating your little fella, you're smoking that bat like a young Lupinella. You'll never get a real woman, ain't no way. But you can play choke it with the chicken all day.
Mommy came in and she caught me one-handed, dreaming about the girl next door. Picture this, I was working that cook and should've locked the bedroom door. How could I get caught while I was picking up a pound of meat? All this time she was standing there, I'm polishing my good friend Pete.
All right, we had a bit of music there.
Radio on.
Radio on.
Radio on.
Radio on.
Radio on.
Radio, radio on. On.
All right, we heard a bit of music there just to break up the thing, break up the interview a little bit. We'll come back to Norman now. We're going to carry on chatting. We've got Norman, the character actor, most well known amongst many films for being Norman Jeffrey. 4 Mile in George and Mildred. I mean, there seems to be a bit of a contrast between you doing these kind of thrillers and Orson Welles films, and you did a film with Roger Moore, and George and Mildred. How did you come by the George and Mildred part?
Well, it's quite strange. It goes back to the National Youth Theatre, because Paula Wilcox was one of the people in the National Youth Theatre with me. And she was doing Man About the House, and she was married to a guy called Derek Seaton, who subsequently died. And Paula asked, there was a part came up in Man About the House, and she asked for me for it, and I went along there. I was so naive, and I was, I didn't even know there was an audience. When they said, do you want tickets? I said, what for? I thought they were just going to film the damn thing. And of course, they have an audience of 400 people every week. But I'd done theatre, so I wasn't too fazed by it, but I was, I'd never done comedy. Not situation comedy, I'd done Shakespearean comedies and things like that. And I fell into it. I just loved doing it. I mean, we got a lot of laughs and things. And then when the part came along for Richard O'Sullivan's brother, they called him Norman, and they offered me that, and I went in and I married Paula Wilcox in it. So it all stemmed back from the National Youth Theatre, really.
So what year are we in about now?
75, 76.
Okay.
And while I was filming with Paula, we were filming at London Weekend Television, and I got Tannoy came over with Norman Ashley of Thames come to the phone. So I went to the phone, talked to my wife. And when I came back, a casting director came up to me and said, I didn't know you would do comedy. And I said, yeah. He said, well, I said, this is the first time I've ever done it. And he said, well, we're doing a series here with David Jason. Do you want to do it? And playing his younger brother. And it wasn't Fools and Horses, don't worry about that.
Okay.
And they offered me a certain amount of money. And I went to my director and I said, they've offered me this for joint lead. It doesn't seem very much. Well, he said, well, can you have a chat with me at lunchtime? So at lunchtime, he and the writers took me into the restaurant at Thames, and they said, look, we're prepared to offer you more money to play a third lead in, because Euther and Brian want you to do it, and George and Mildred. By then I knew Euther and Brian, and we're really good friends. So, so I then decided I'd go in and do it.
Okay. I mean, you've done thrillers, mysteries, actions, adventures, and comedy. I mean, what's out of that kind of rather large variety, what is your favourite to do?
I liked them all. I mean, I think I sort of liked, there was one of the thrillers I really loved because it was the easiest part in the world. I was playing a guy just being convicted of killing 13 women.
Right.
So you don't have to act after that. You've just got to be as nice as possible.
Yeah.
And he escapes and everything. That was great fun. I really think probably The Sound of the Laughter coming back at you was great. And I got a lot of stage, once I was doing George and Mildred, I was doing a lot of stage plays. And some of them are very good comedies, like I did Same Time Next Year,
yeah,
which is just two people, and we toured England with that. And it was great just hearing them all laugh. It was wonderful.
I mean, do you think there's any... I mean, you were in a film in which you played a father, a Catholic priest.
Yeah, that was the... The House of Mortal Sin.
House of Mortal Sin. Yeah. I mean, that one received a bit of criticism about the way that it sort of portrayed Catholics. I mean, do you think there's... Have you ever come across a limit in your acting where you think, well, I'm not sure what you're asking me to act here. Do you have a... I mean, where do morals come into your choice as an actor? Do you have a limited range? Do you say, I want to do this kind of thing? Or do you just kind of take everything just as a job?
No, don't do that. I've just had been offered a job, which I've turned down, because I think at my age it's sort of a bit undignified. I was asked to do a love scene with a woman of my age.
Right.
Naked.
Okay.
And I thought, no. The last was naked when I was about 54, and I think that was pushing it a bit. But the girl I was made naked with then was a gorgeous 26-year-old, so I think I was all right. I'd never read any criticism of the House of Mortal Sin, but I mean, I was playing opposite Stephanie Beecham, and I was going to give up the priesthood for Stephanie. Well, you can't think of a better reason for giving up the priesthood than Stephanie Beecham. About 15, 20 years ago. No, it was more than that, but 25 years ago. And she's a lovely person. I worked with her in London in a play for the Royal Shakespeare Company called The Rover, which I broke my leg on the 13th performance, which is good. So that was the end of me in that play.
Yeah, yeah. You worked with Bill Kerr once in one film I read of Hancock's Harbour.
Yeah.
Did you chat to him much?
I didn't even speak to him. I mean, that's one of the problems with working on films is you don't, unless you do a read-through, you never meet some of the people that are in the film.
Yeah.
We worked together once. I mean, I was talking to Alan Armstrong the other day, and he said, what have we worked in? I said, I don't think we have. And you have to think we might have been in something together, but not actually done the same scene or something.
I mean, friendships in acting circles, as you go through all these, I mean, are most of them just kind of transient, and then they just come and they go, and you don't come back to them? Or do you tend to build up friendships?
It depends. I mean, you can run into someone having not seen them for 10 years and they're still your best mate or one of your best mates. I know that sounds silly, but someone like Ricky Tomlinson, I've got a great mate who did 10 years in Zedcars, Douglas Fielding. Now, Dougie lives in Canterbury, and I can't see him that often. But when I wrote this play, I sent it to him, and I asked him to play a part, and he did. And we just fall into it. Some people you'd never see again and don't particularly want to.
Right.
And they don't particularly want to see you. But when you do make a friend in this business, I mean, I can't tell you that. But I was working out the other day because I saw Dennis Waterman and ran into him. And we've been friends for 38 years. We've only worked together four times.
Right.
But the first time we worked together was in 1968 at a play, in a play at the Royal Court, which got rid of the Lord Chamberlain. And I've been friends with Dennis ever since, and yet I probably don't see him, well, maybe see him six or seven times in that time, but yeah. it's he is my mate, and it's but the play at the Royal Court that we got rid of the Chamberlain was a play by Edward Bond, and it had all sorts of very strange people in it. Marion Faithfull was in it for one, Jack Shepherd and Moira Redman and Dennis, as I said, and they'd sent the play to the Lord Chamberlain, came back full of no you can't do it, so they said, well, we're going to put it on. Well, you'll all be arrested if you do put it on. Well, we're going to put it on as club theatre.
Right.
So they did it on a Sunday night. Just before we went, I looked out into Sloane Square, and it was packed with the press, police, crowds just wondering what the hell was going on. And we were told that if the police came into the order to break into Shakespeare. And in the end, we did the play and did the whole thing, and the next morning, end of the Lord Chamberlain.
Wow, and did you ever think at that point, what have I got myself into? I mean, is this?
It was exciting, but yeah. It was the 60s. I mean, we were on the end of the King's Road in Sloane Square. It was the 60s. Everything was happening.
I mean, I noticed you say the 60s there. I mean, how has things changed since then? What's the biggest changes in acting over the years?
In acting, I think it's people. There are some very good actors. I don't think there's enough outlet for acting on television. There's some very, very, very good young actors. But a lot of people are going into the business, and not necessarily just into the business, but trying to get themselves on television because they're after celebrity, because celebrity is what pays these days.
Yeah.
And if you can do a shortcut by going on, one of the, reality shows or Big Brother or anything like that, those kids have made more money in their own year than I've made in my life. And that's a simple fact.
So you've got one thing to say to people who are considering sort of serious acting and they don't know, not sure what to do, or what would you say as words of encouragement to?
I would say if you want to do it, nothing will stop you.
Yeah.
And the best thing you can do is maybe apply to the National Youth Theatre in London, or apply to local youth theatres. Join theatre groups around Bristol. I was doing loads of amateur work in Bristol. And try and get yourself into a decent drama school.
Okay.
And because it's like every other walk of life now, it's qualifications, and you need the qualifications or where you've been.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for chatting to us, Norman.
My
actually,
pleasure,
yeah, John. We may have time to come back to you later in the show, sort of dependent on how everything else goes, but I've really enjoyed chatting to you. And we've now got some time for some music.
Thanks, John.
Okay, actually, we're going to go to the recipe feature. We've been having a recipe feature every week, as you know. Today, we've got Chris, who makes his own homemade soups, and he sells them in St. Nicholas Market, and he's now going to give us one of his own recipes.
As Chris, I run a homemade soup stall in St. Nicholas Market 3 days a week, on a Tuesday, Thursday and Friday. Everybody's welcome to come down and try them. And today, I've been asked by Radio Dialect to reveal the secret of one of my recipes to you.
Go on, then.
Well, this is a good one for the winter. It's a spiced lentil soup, perfect for vegetarians and vegans, for that matter. First of all, take a large onion and chop that finely, and sweat that down in a little oil in a large stock pot. Then chop up about an inch of ginger and a garlic clove. Again, finely, and throw that in with the onion and sweat that for a little as well. Add a little bit of crushed chilli, probably no more than about half a teaspoon, depends how much you like the soup, it's up to you. And then add some crushed coriander seeds, about a tablespoon, and a tablespoon of allspice, and cook that down for about 3 or 4 minutes. Then you add 1 can of coconut milk, 700 mils of vegetable stock, and 150 grams of lentils. And I use poi lentils because they look quite nice and they're not too big. And
Are those pre-soaked, or do you have to soak them first? Or?
No, you don't have to soak them. You can put them into the liquid dry, and they take about 45 minutes to cook. Again, it depends how, if you like your lentils with a bit of bite in, or whether you like them quite soft. But just simmer away, and it's as simple as that. The soup is then done. You don't need to do anything more to it except enjoy it.
Dialect is your local internet radio station. Check out our website on radiodialect.net.
Alright, that was Chris. That's good to hear from him, and no doubt we'll have more soup recipes coming up in the future. Now for a feature. Last week, you remember, Tony did a feature where he recorded the Brunel tour. Now we're going to carry on with this week. Tony, our Dalek reporter, was there, and he brings you the report now.
In front of, we all know that during the Victorian times the class system existed, and it had to apply to the station as well when people travelled. So we are standing in front of three bookings offices, two second class bookings offices, one first class. What we don't know is we are the third class booked, but what we do know is that there was a third class carriage attached to the trains. And it's such a contrast in certain illustrations and photographs of a third class carriage to a first class carriage. Wooden benches in a third class carriage, velvet seating in a first class carriage, padded seating in a first class carriage. More than 20 people probably stuffed in a third class carriage, you know. Maybe three or four in a first class. It was just, it's up terribly different. Sorry? Well, you know what? We were thinking that as well, because if you look at the Great Western Railway train today, they have a class system as well. You have your first class carriage, your business class carriage. It happens in the planes as well. Yeah. So in a way, it still exists, is that we all book at the same time. From the middle door, from the middle bookings office door, a spiral staircase took you up onto the departures platform. Within the bookings offices was a pulley system. You could put your luggage, etc., to get up onto the departures platform. From the two architectural features on either side of these doors, glass canopies came all the way back to the far end here. And this was, I think, a big marketing ploy of Brunel's. How else is it going to convince a Victorian passenger that this was a grand affair? This was probably the new way of thinking. The Victorian woman that stood with her Victorian gown to queue and the cold weather to get onto that train for the very first time. You've got to have those kinds of tactics. Many people say they don't build railway stations like this anymore, because the idea behind it, I think, if you just drive past it, or many people have drove past it, you think it was something out of a royal book, a castle-like effect. And you can see that in evidence of his big tower-like structures over here. The railways extended all the way to the far end, and navvies were men who worked on the railway lines, hundreds of them, and hundreds of them died as well. You know, can you imagine carrying? They used to carry, manually carry. They had no machinery, etc. Manually carry things to put onto the floor. I know the BRI has got a certain record of how many navvies died at that time, or how many arrived at the BRI to injured of some sort. They set up tents for their families and things to live along the railways. It was very, very difficult, a very hard life for navvies and people who worked on the railways. So I'll take you now back inside, and we're going to look at the director's staircase and all that we came out from, and get out of the cold.
Monstrosities like that built next to it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's wicked. It is, isn't it?
Even though horrible. When the last train left this Bristol Temple meet, it was as late as the 1960s, so not that far off, not that far away. And when it left, the whole station shut, and everything remained as it was. Then it became the Exploratory. Then the Museum Trust decided to, the Commonwealth Institute closed, and the Museum Trust, etc., decided to restore the building. And I think English Heritage decided to help us out with £250,000. But it cost the museum a good few million pounds to get it restored, to get it looking like it is today, on the way of being a Grade II listed building. So this building, the designing, the engineering, the runnings of the train didn't happen overnight. I mean, if 1828 he only arrived in Bristol, things had to be passed in Parliament. Acts had to be passed in Parliament. And the official act was passed in 1835 to say yes, trains can start running between Bristol and London. But the initial journeys were like short journeys, Bristol to Bath, then Bristol to Chippenham, then Bristol to Swindon. And then they became more confident in running longer journeys. But what we do know is that 1840, and this is a scroll, the official scroll at the very top, that says 1840, in which the first train left Bristol to head off towards London. But I couldn't believe that an act had to be passed, several acts had to be passed in Parliament to approve of trains running, so that the station can be up and running. He needed to pass an act in Parliament for the broad gauge to be approved. You know, so it was all very considered very serious matters to be done. So just like how Brunel wanted to impress the passenger, I think he needed to impress the board members and the director of the board. And this entrance was specially designed for that purpose, because this staircase leads you to that boardroom we were once sitting in. This staircase is called the director's staircase, for obvious reasons, made out of solid oak. And when we acquired the building, the staircase was covered in a thick white emulsion paint. And a gentleman on the Brunel opening weekend, the birthday weekend in April, he was from St. Pancras Station, and he said even at some point in St. Pancras Station, they also went through a phase of painting wooden, lovely oak panelling, white paint. I don't know what happened with all the stations. But a local art college had come in and they took it on as a project. And I think it took them almost 9 months just to get it looking, stripping it and etc. to get it looking like it is today. But you can see him bringing the exterior to the interior as well, just from one staircase with this tower-like features spaced along. So we'll make our way up. And
the door is on.
Yes, they would have been. There would have been doors along here to get people. Oh, and before I forget, this used to serve as the offices for Great Western Railway office members. And the front part of the building, where you find blackened windows, I'm not sure if anybody, the bus stops on the outside, the blackened windows, used to be shops, or if people wanted to post things, you know, to send things via freight, etc. They used to just come and queue on the far end on the outside. Hence why the big windows on the outside are very much larger than the rest of the building.
Dialect is a community project run by volunteers, and we need you. If you'd like to get involved, check out our website at radiodialect.net.
To check it out, 19 extra larges. What a shame, no one came. Just us eating all alone. You said take the pizza home. No sense letting all this go to waste. So then I faced pizza all day and every day. This cheese round the clock is getting me blocked, and I sure don't care for irregularity. Why'd you have to go and make me so constipated? 'Cause right now I'd do anything to just get my bowels evacuated. In the bathroom, I sit and I wait and I strain and I sweat and I clench and I feel the pain. Oh, should I take laxatives or have my colon irrigated? No, no, no. I was feeling pretty down till my girlfriend came around. We're just so alike in every way, I gotta say. In fact, I just thought I might pop the question there that night. I was kissing her so tenderly, but woe is me. Who would have guessed her family crest I'd suddenly spy, tattooed on her thigh, and son of a gun, it's just like the one on me. Tell me, how was I supposed to know we were both related? Believe me, if I knew she was my cousin, we never would have dated. What to do now? Should I go ahead and propose and get hitched and have kids with 11 toes and move to Alabama where the kind of thing is tolerated? No, 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 night unwind. Try out that new roller coaster ride. And the guide said not to stand, but that's a demand that I couldn't meet. I got on my feet and stood up instead and knocked off my head. You see, tell me, why'd I have to go and get myself decapitated? This really is a major inconvenience. Oh man, I really hate it. Such a drag now. Can't eat, I can't breathe, I can't snore, I can't belch or yodel anymore. Can't spit or roll my nose or even read Sports Illustrated. Oh no, why'd I have to go and get myself all mutilated? Without a head, kinda makes me irritated. What a bummer. I can't blink, I can't cough, I can't sneeze, but my neck is enjoying a pleasant breeze now. Haven't been the same since my head and I was separated. No, no, no.
Alright, that's Weird Al Yankovic. That was Constipated, which is an Avril Lavigne kind of parody. Previous to that, we also played Caught One-Handed by Chris Smalls, which was a Shaggy parody as well. Thank you, Jeff, for those. We've now got time for the quiz. Just to let you know, next week we have the last part of the Brunel tour, which is the piece we heard before the music. Next week we go down into the bowels, down into the vaults of Temple Mead Station. So that's the last part of the Bruno tour next week. Now time for the quiz. Are you ready? Here we go. Who is the woman and who is she talking about? We've been doing this for a few weeks now. Text your answer and phone. I'll give you a mobile number in just a second. If you could win a Radio Dialect exclusive T-shirt. Gavin drew the pictures for these and they're very nice too. There's a limited number of these and we'll just be running this quiz on and on till somebody solves the question. Alright.
He told me that his hands closed up when he was at university and that it was this pivotal time of his sexuality as a young man. And it was many years later when I realised that they closed much, much later and he'd already been married and had children. But he would tell you a story, become very distressed, become very moved by it, and you believed utterly that that had formed him in some way. And I became convinced that this was reflected in his work. The reason why his work was so sexual and had such a strong sexual content was that in some way he'd been sort of castrated as a young man by this condition. And in fact, that, you know, didn't exist until much, much later.
What was that woman? Who was she? You can email studio@radiodialect.net. You can also text or phone this mobile. The number is 07786 952037. If you are from abroad, then if you put +44 instead of O, so it would be +44 7786 952037. Alright, we're going to keep running and running and running till you get the answer, so please text or email us. We're going to go over to Jeff now for our weekly slot of What's On.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your weekly What's On guide from Radio Dialect. Starting with tomorrow night and at the Croft in Stoatscroft, Bristol, Kid Carpet will be performing with support from three hoes, two Mexicans and a tin of Spanners. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £6 on the door. Also tomorrow night, and this time at Queen's Head in Eastern Road, Lawrence Hill, Bristol, Disorder will be performing with support from Rita Lynch and Man Down. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. On to Song of the Week, and it's time to get into the festive spirit with a track from Billy Idol's recent album, Devil's Playground. This is the track, Yelling at the Christmas Tree.
My daddy, he don't hear 'em. He's
yelling at the Christmas tree. Santa's balls are jingling, mommy's hips are wiggling, but daddy, he don't hear 'em. He's yelling at the Christmas tree. All right now, yeah. Uncle is a sportsman, Granny likes a joke, but no one laughs when Daddy stumbles home. But he don't fall asleep while the night was getting black. You see, oh God, Dad had too much Jack. Oh no, every year it's the same old thing, like a Rudolph's red nose, telling the story never will get old. All the Christmas bells are ringing and the carolers are singing, but Daddy, he don't hear 'em. He's yelling at the Christmas tree. Santa's balls are jingling, Mommy's hips are wiggling, but Daddy, he don't hear 'em. He's yelling at the Christmas tree. All right now, yeah. All right now, yelling at the Christmas tree. Santa came down the chimney, but then he ran upstairs, jumped in bed with Mommy, she didn't care. Across the room went the fruitcake, all the wreath came off the door. If these are holidays, I can't take no more. Every year it's the same old thing, like a Rudolph's red nose, telling a story never will get old. Oh, the Christmas bells are ringing and the carolers are singing, my daddy, he don't hear 'em. He's yelling at the Christmas tree. Santa's balls are jingling, Mommy's hips are wiggling, but Daddy, he don't hear 'em. He's yelling at the Christmas tree. Santa's balls are jingling, Mommy's hips are wiggling, but Daddy, he don't hear 'em. He's yelling at the Christmas tree.
That was Billy Idol with Yelling at the Christmas Tree. For more information on this musician, you can check him out at www.billyidol.com. Moving on to Saturday night, and at the Full Moon in Stotescroft, Bristol, Dub from Atlantis Band will be performing. The gig should start around 9 p.m, and entry is a £5 on the door. Also on Saturday night, and this time at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol, the country rockers The Harrisons will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m, and entry is £4 on the door. Finally, on to Sunday at the Fleecing Firkin in Bristol, Spear of Destiny will be performing. Doors open at 7:30 p.m, and tickets are £9 in advance. Also on Sunday night, and this time at the Cheese and Grain in Frome, the Yardbirds will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m, and tickets are £13 in advance, and £15 on the door. That is all from me tonight. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend. Take care and good night.
All right, thank you, Jeff. It's nearly the end of another Radio Dalek show. So before we go, we've got time for a poem. Before we go, we've got Sonia, who's a local girl, a poem dedicated to all those depressed baby boomers. And it's called Sodin 60.
We were both 1944 babes, born in the Chinese year, the monkey, vintage year. I've known her for about 10 years, and to celebrate this milestone of our lives, I penned this little ode to being 60, and it's called Sodding 60. Right. This sodding age is a sodding cuss. Who wants cheaper fares on a sodding bus when no one really fancies us? It's sodding 60. Our sodding memories getting sodding bad. Our closest friends, we're sodding mad. Our brightest moments are sodding sad, it's sodding 60. A sodding facelift is sodding dear. And is it worth it? No sodding fear. It makes us just look more sodding queer, it's sodding 60. If a good-looking fellow makes us smile, he sees our age as sodden vile. It only cramps our sodden style, being sodden 60. The sodden outlook is sodden cold. We know we're getting sodden old. We can't get fellas for level gold, it's sodding 60. So paint the town bright sodding red and keep your fellow good in bed. Or Susie, we might as well be sodding dead, it's sodding 60. The sodding years like grains of sand have sodding well slipped through our hand. But Susie, despite it all, you look sodding grand at sodding 60. To my little friend.
Oh, thank you for that. Thank you, Sonia. Could she have been in a bonnet about her age? I don't know. You decide. Well, it looks like that might be all for this week. Have we got time for another track? Yeah, we're going to play another track. So remind you, next week we'll be interviewing Edward rapidly live in the studio about cabaret squatting and art squatting, and Ursula, who writes modern-day fairy stories, plus a feature. Carmen Alfonso will be reading poems from her book. Pretty packed week, actually, next week. We've also got William Rodriguez. We've got a feature. Tony Gosling, our intrepid reporter, interviewed him. He was the last official person out of the World Trade Center. He's the janitor of the North Tower, and he is the chairman of the Victim Support Group. Yeah, so we've got a feature about him next week. Let's listen to some music, though.
Hello, Tread, what are you doing in the studio?
I'm making a punk reggae record.
You're not in a punk, are you?
Well, not really for me, but it's for my mate Dickie Dinkle. He's in hospital at the moment. Here, sit down and have a listen to this.
1, 2, 3, 4... Plastic bag and long johns, a pin stuck through his nose. 20 yards of cars, he chain, he thinks it's quite a pose to be a big punk, big punk. That's what they call him, big punk, big punk. He goes down to the Roxy and pogos with the punks. He nuts and whacks the geezers and the birds, kicks in the c***. He's a big punk, big punk. That's what they call him, big punk. A coalman, he delivers down your road, and for any randy punk bird, he'll always shoot his load, cos he's a big punk, big punk. That's what they call him, big punk, big punk. That's what they call him. Here, I went out with a punk bird the other night. She had a lovely body on her.
Oh yeah,
mine. See the crowd he goes with. They really look absurd. Crutchless tights and fishnets. That's the fellas, not the birds. Cos they are big punks, big punks. That's what they call them. Big punks, big punks. He never was a rocker. He always was a punk. You should hear the chains clanking when he gives his bird a bunk. Cos she's a big punk, big punk. That's what they call her. Big punk. But now he's stuck in hospital for an accident he's had. Got caught out in a rainstorm and went rusty. Still he's glad that he's a big punk, big punk. That's what they call him, big punk, big punk. That's what they call him.
Here, Dred.
What?
You ever stuck a pin in your ear hole?
No, I ain't.
I've got a nice big pin here, look at this one.
Cool, ain't it? Big!
Go on, stick it in your ear.
Not so lightly.
Stick it in your cheek.
No way.
Stick it in your bleeding helmet then.
Oh, not so lightly.
Here, let's stick it through your belly.
Okay then, I won't be frightened.
It won't hurt.
I'll count to three.
Right.
Ready?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3. Oh!
We had a bit more Judge Dredd then. Oh, I like that very much. Last but not least, if you're stuck for something to do right now, we've got the Roughneck Discotheque going on at Timbuktu. It's rhythm and bass to wind up your waist, so you can go to that if you like. Well, that's it for this week. So the weather forecast was courtesy of met.check.com. The news and weather was read by the wonderful Richard Ayres, as per usual. Studio managers were Richard Ayres and Gavin Thomas. The What's On by Jeff Sparks, as usual. We had reporter Tony Gosling doing the Brunel tour, and it's produced by Anthea Page. And last but not least, a very good thank you, a big thank you to Norman Eshley. We very much enjoyed him in the studio today. It was really great talking to him. I've been John Peters Colwyn. Tune in the same time next week for more of the same.